I cheated. I looked at your name, Floyd. I don't want to make any mistakes up here tonight. I'm glad the Al-Anon helped me out this morning when she forgot, because then I know I'll be all right with now. Made me less nervous for the rest of the day. I'm Jim. I'm an alcoholic. And I appreciate the committee that asked me to come here. Mont Eagle's always been fond of my heart, even though I haven't been here for a good many years. Gloria and I, after the early 80s, began to take care of our children for a good many years. And so we've gone through the whole process of raising the kids, and now we're raising grandbabies. But it's good for me to be here tonight. I've had such a wonderful weekend, and Dawn and Paula, to set the stage right as far as I'm concerned. It makes it a lot easier when people give it to you and you put it, and you know that I've always enjoyed it. It's been a great conference already, so it's so we're on the downhill side of it right now. I love the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I love the program of Al-Anon too. I probably was an Al-Anon long before I became an alcoholic. I know that. But the type of alcoholic I was, I suffered from alcoholism for 16 years. 12 years I suffered from alcoholism and still continue to hate a father who died of alcoholism. That's an alcoholic. That's only an alcoholic can do such a thing, can continue to justify their own drinking, yet hate somebody else for dying drunk. And that's exactly the manner of what my alcoholism did for me. I haven't had a drink of alcohol since January the 10th, 1972. I used to say it hasn't been necessary for me to have a drink, but several years ago, I guess it's probably been 25 years ago now, I was in a meeting over at Center Point, and they were giving out the chips one night, and this gal was up giving out the chips and said, want a 24-hour chip? And then came to a 30-day chip, and this guy named Joe, he stood up, and he stood up to get his 30-day chip, he said, I'm Joe, I'm an alcoholic, and it hasn't been necessary for me to take a drink in the last 30 days. And his wife was sitting beside him, and she took her elbow and hit him in the side. She said, Joe, you got drunk last night. He said, I know, but it wasn't necessary. So I was kind of like old Joe. I drank when it wasn't necessary. I think the stages of alcoholism are set long before we get here. But as I share the things that happened to me in my life, and I think one of the tragedies I've run into, and I don't know if it's a tragedy or not, but one of the problems we run into in this program is today we know better. But this is not an I should have known better disease. It's a disease that affects people in such a manner that it doesn't matter how much information or how much intellect you know about this illness, it still can get to you. And you're just as innocent when you have all the vast knowledge of what the book can give you and all the vast knowledge of what other books can give you. We still have a degree of innocence about us in the disease of addiction. It's not like I can learn enough information so that now I go out and now I'm no longer, now I'm protected against this illness. Because sometimes the more I learn about this illness, the worse it is. I think the one thing that I've learned probably more than anything else in this world, I was raised by a grandmother who really gave me some of the basic principles of my life early on in life. She raised 13 kids, 10 of her own and 3 of us. And this woman, I really believe deep down inside of me, I believe that this woman really just didn't know any better. She hung in there with us. Most of her kids were raised, she hung in there with us to stay at home and raise us, even though her husband was continued to drink and my dad and the rest of the family that was around us drank. She could have went anywhere. She could have went with her one son who was a priest. She could have went with another son who was a doctor. Yet she stayed with us. Yet she had a simple spirituality that I felt rolled on the air of on the side of ignorance. I really believed if that woman knew better, she would get the hell out. That she wouldn't stick around and stay with us. I didn't understand why she stayed. I always wondered. I wonder why this woman just doesn't go. If she had any sense at all, she'd break and run. But her job in this thing called life was to take care of her kids and take care of us. And that's exactly what she did. And I remember early on in life when I went to her about my grandfather, and I went to her and I said, you know, what's going on with Grandpap? I mean, you know, I was all upset because of something he was doing with his drinking, you know. And she looked at me and she said, you know, if Grandpap knew how to do any better, he wouldn't do it. You know, he would do it differently. He just don't know any better, Jimmy. He just doesn't know how to do it any differently. And she lived her life like that. She never went to an Al-Anon meeting in her life, but I think she had the basic concepts of what this program means, and she was able to adjust herself and live with that kind of stuff. She lived under the fire of all the humiliation, degradation that somebody goes through when you suffer from alcoholism. I mean, yet she stayed on with us kids to the bitter end. And yet I know today that woman was not an ignorant woman. That woman had some of the most powerful spiritual information I ever found in my life through a person. And I learned through Tom B. I read some inserts into his book, but one of the things that Tom said in his book is that recovery, sobriety, spirituality is a growing down process. That we grow down and we get rid of. This program's about removing things, bringing things to the surface and getting rid of them. And getting down to the basic facts of life, of spirituality in our life, that we can live. You know, it's not like people say, well, why do you know some information about the big book? I said, you know, if I'd have stayed in the first grade and read Dick and Jane, Spot Loves Pot, Puff, and all that stuff for 32 years, by God, I'd be pretty smart about that too. And that's what AA keeps me doing. If I keep in the concepts or the basic concepts of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, then I learn about Puff. And I learn about Spot and Dick and Jane and Mother and all that stuff. And I don't have to go outside the concepts of that spirituality. If I can stick to the basic spiritual foundation that's written out in that book. And I really loved it when Paula said that she took her inventory by the foundation of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not a prude. I think if there's any other way of making it through an inventory, go do it that way. But if you're going to set a foundation in life, the simple concepts that are found in that book are the most powerful information that I've ever read in my life as far as setting a foundation. A foundation, whatever you put on that building, whatever you put on that house is strictly up to you once you do that. But when you have that simple foundation set, when you have that set in that simplicity, then you're on your road. You know, then you're on your road. But the tragedy of this is that, you know, for most of us, how deep we have to suffer. And that's the way it is for most of us in this room. How deep, not the fact that we had to suffer, how deep we have to suffer before we begin to find out the simple truths by which we have to live. That's the tragedy of this program. And most people, once we reach a certain point, we really feel like we've done too much damage. Once we reach that point where we feel like we're at that part where, you know, my God, why didn't I do it? We get those if onlys. If only I'd have done it 4 years ago. Well, if only I'd have done it when I was married to my first wife or my second wife or all that stuff. But the problem about this is, you know, this is the disease. And once we reach that point of hopelessness, and I think that's exactly what happens with the newcomer. If we push that person into that hopelessness, if we keep him in that hopeless position, then it's easier. The more hopeless I became, the easier it was for me to accept simple spiritual terms. When I have hope, I don't want to bend my will to God's will. I want God to bend His will to my will. But when I'm hopeless, I could care less, man. Just I don't want to do it my way. I want to get rid of me as quick as I can. And it's simpler for me to live that way. It's simpler for me to turn it over like that. And when I'm like that today, and I can live by the concepts of this program, all the prayers I've learned, I still use the prayer. I still read the prayers. I read the prayer, the third step prayer. I always read the third step prayer. I read that six and seven step prayer. I read these things. I keep the book with me. I don't want to screw the message up. But I got a mind that'll screw the message up. I remember several years ago, and Jim D and Jim H, and they were all down in Montgomery, and they were doing the Ask It Basket one Saturday. I think it was Saturday. They used to do it on Saturday night, I think it was, Mickey. And they pulled the four step out of the Ask It Basket, and they said, Jim, let's come up and do the four step. And they had a piece of paper, and they went to hand it to me. I don't know whether it was Jim D or Jim H. But I said, no, that's okay, I know. And I got up there. Now, I didn't take the sheet of paper with the information on it. And I got up there and say, step four, continue to take personal inventory. and when we were wrong. And that's not the fourth step, that's the tenth step. And I'm standing up here, you know, and if I'd have, you know, I would have never, if I'd have stood up for 3 days, I could have never remembered what the fourth step was from there on in. I was done. And I thought, you know, that's kind of arrogance. Don't read the instructions, Jim. You know, just go up there and sign off. So I take the book with me. And I got all these things written down. Not that I want to do a straight out talk, but by God, I got them written down. So if I lose my place, Ralph still helps me. He's passed away, but he still helps me when I call him, my sponsor. I was telling Larry and Paula, I was up in Ohio several years ago. Man, I lost my place right in the middle of a talk up there in front of, I don't know how many people were terrified. I was terrified to begin with. And Ralph was sitting right down there, and I said, my God, where was I? He said, it don't matter, just continue on no matter where you are. Because he said, I forget too, you know. You know, so I haven't just had this problem. I went down in Columbus, Georgia some years ago when I was younger, and I stood at the podium of Alcoholics Anonymous and right in front of God and everybody, I said, there's two things that I remember vividly the day I got sober. And I couldn't think of either one of them. I mean, why do you do that in front of all these people? Vivid. I mean, not two things I remember, two things I remember vividly. There you go with vividly, right out the door. You know, if I'd have stood up for 300 years, I'd have never thought about what it was. You know, so I don't want to get the message screwed up. Let me see what it was I remember. Even though I was raised up under the cloud of alcoholism, I didn't know better. I think, I just didn't know better. I didn't know there was any other way to live. That's, you know, when a kid's raised away, that's the way it is. So you don't know the difference. You don't know the difference until you get out there, you begin to grow up and get out there in life, and you realize that all these other guys in town didn't envy you. They, you know, especially their moms and dads, they didn't want their children going. My mom and dad, and that was one of the things I forgot already. I wasn't raised in a good Christian home. I was raised in a bar. So that kind of validates that. But being raised in a bar, and that's one reason I mentioned my sisters, they was raised in the same bar, and they're not alcoholic either. They're not alcoholic. They're Al-Anons. And they are what they should have been for being raised in a bar under all this stuff was going on there, you know. Living under alcoholism, in the earlier days, I always say my social drinking started when I was 7 or 8 years old. I was allowed to drink a bottle of Rolling Rock. You know, I'd go out to the bar and get a bottle of Rolling Rock, back and watch Video Adventure and Howdy Doody. I never remember booze changing me. You know, I never abused it. I would go out. I'd rather drink 3 or 4 bottles of Coca-Cola or pop before I drink. But so alcohol didn't change me. I had a vivid imagination anyways. I could be John Wayne. I could be whoever I wanted to be out there in the yard. I could be Audie Murphy. I'd run through the bushes and did what I needed to do, you know. So my imagination, I wasn't just a withdrawn kid. I was out there in the open and I was fired. And I didn't have to do anything to expedite this brain of mine. I mean, I had an imagination from way back, you know. But one of the things about being up in this mountain that I got also is I've got this inner ear stuff. So if I go out on you, don't worry about it. My ears have been, I just feel like I'm full right now. My ears are just cracking inside, you know, so I'm trying to stay away from that. Anyways, I got off track there. But being raised in a hotel, and being raised around alcohol, I never knew the difference. But my dad was told back in 1955, he went to the doctors. He ended up, he had a convulsion, and it was because of cirrhosis of the liver. And he ended up in the hospital. When he came back out of that hospital, the doctor told him if he didn't stop drinking, he was going to die. And, you know, I never connected alcohol with dying. I connected drinking with fighting and loving and singing and, you know, all kinds of crazy stuff. But I never knew people that drank died. But I figured, my God, he'll stop. You know, I know he'll stop. And my dad was 36 years old back in 1955. And I believe today that my dad loved me and my mother and my sisters As much as I love my wife, and by the way, this is my wife, Gloria. Stand up, Gloria. She's one of the reasons I love her. I love her. I got to tell you a couple of stories about her later on. She's qualified for Al-Anon, too. But I knew my dad would stop. I knew he loved me. But I know my dad loved me and my mother and my sisters as much as I love my kids and my grandbabies and my wife and things today. I knew that. But he didn't stop. He'd come back and he drank again and died. And I hated that man. And I hated that man for the next 16 years. 12 of those years, I was an active practicing alcoholic myself. How you can do that is what alcoholics do. But the thing that concerned me the most in all that stuff is that I know today that when that doctor told him that, it wasn't an alternative to drinking. When that doctor told my dad, if you don't stop drinking, you're going to die, I know it was a death sentence. I know that today. I know he didn't have a chance. I know he went back, and I know he probably died feeling the same things that I felt about him. You know, I mean, I didn't have a problem with people with alcoholism. I love my grandfather, who was I don't know whether either one of these guys were alcoholics. I know they suffered from alcoholism deeply. My grandfather never worked the last 30 years. That's why he came to. My dad went and pulled the rest of the family in that was not raised yet, and my grandmother. So they could live in that bar, and he could take care of business, you know. But, you know, I love my grandfather. I love my grandfather because he was there. It didn't matter whether he was drunk. It didn't matter whether he abused me. I mean, I don't mean abuse me to the extent he wasn't. God love him. I don't think he was tough enough to abuse me. I made it look like he abused me. I remember running to my grandmother once after he abused me. And I was crying. And she said, "Don't you come running to me." She said, "Every time that old man's in there passed out asleep in that bed, you go in there and you start tormenting the living hell out of him." And she said, "You take off and run off with your friends. Who do you think he comes and gets after you get him up? You go in there and you throw water on him, you catch him on fire, you do all kinds of crap with him." You know. And I used to do that. You know, he used to give me a haircut every day. Every time he'd get drunk, he'd give me a haircut, and he got drunk every day. My wife knows this. She can't put clippers on my head today. He'd give me a haircut with those hand clippers, and he'd pull my temples on. You know, I had blood running down my cheeks. He would like to give a haircut. He was a barber, but he couldn't barber, only me, you know. He was a bartender and a barber. He couldn't do either one. God love him, but I loved the man. I really did. I loved the man because I don't think my grandfather, and that's another thing, I only smile at him because I know he never had a chance. But I love my grandfather because, unlike my dad, when my dad died at 36 years old, he left a host of fair weather friends behind. People always told me most of my life, "You should be like your dad," and I hated him for that. They never told me I should have been like my grandfather. My grandfather hung there with me. I didn't give a damn whether he was drunk or sober. He was there with me. Where's my old man at? And that's the one thing I can give my grandfather credit for. He hung in there with us. You know, he hung there with us all his life. And I love that man. I love that man for staying with us, both them people. I stopped drinking when my dad died when I was 11 years old. 4 years later, I had studied religion, and I'm not, you know, I wasn't deeply religious person, but I studied with my grandmother, and I studied some books and studied some religion and thought I'd build a spiritual foundation on something, and really it was just on hatred. Hatred not to be like my old man. But when I was 15 years old, when I turned 16 years old, I went to a youth center dance with these guys one night, and I was sitting outside this youth center dance, and they were passing around a bottle of wine. And I let the bottle of wine go. I didn't drink it. They passed around a couple of times, and I didn't drink it. And I walked inside that dance. I got away from them guys, so I'm going in to dance. And I walked in that dance, and I looked across the dance hall, and there was this girl named Beverly. Now, Beverly was the cutest girl that I ever found in my life. I was in love with Beverly from first grade on. We're here, we are. We're in about ninth or tenth grade now. I'm still in love with Beverly. You know, I looked across the dance hall, man, she's sparkling, you know. And I made up my mind. I mean, she was the first girl I ever kissed, playing spin the bottle at the hotel. We were playing spin the bottle. I kissed her in the phone booth at the hotel. So I wasn't shy about Beverly. But when I walked into that youth center dance, Sparkling Beverly, as I approached her in that dance hall, she started looking meaner than hell. Man, I backed off. I thought, man, I backed off and went back outside. I said, man, that girl, she's mean as hell. Look at her. And I went back out there, and I got into that wine with those guys, and they passed the bottle of wine around, and I just took a big drink out of that bottle of wine. And I felt a little bit better about me and my old man. And one thing that wine did, when I went back into that dance, I looked across the dance hall, started walking up to Beverly, and she looked like she was happy to see me. I asked her to dance, and that wine made her say yes. I know it did. Because the next week I come back to the dance, I was sober when I come into the dance. I didn't drink outside with the guys. Walked into the dance hall. Beverly was meaner than hell. Went back out there and got into the wine. Came back in and she was happy. I drank the wine and Beverly got happy to see me. But you know what happened there? Alcohol changed the world I lived in. Alcohol made the world less hostile. Alcohol made Beverly less hostile. Alcohol gave me a courage. And what that alcohol did, the great paradox of alcoholism, of drinking, of alcohol, is what that booze did when I went out there and got into that booze, it made me complete as a human being. Whatever that booze did to me, it did whatever that little girl saying yes would do. It completed it. So really, when I went back into that dance, I could have cared less if Beverly said yes or no. I was already okay. Now, if that's the only thing booze would have done for me from that day to this day, I'd still be out there doing it. But the other part of the deal is, I took a drink of alcohol which made me complete, but I never felt finished. And that's the physical allergy to alcohol. I took a couple of drinks which made me complete, but I never felt finished. And the doctor's opinion spells that out. We drink essentially because we like the effects produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while we admit that it is injurious, we cannot, after a time, differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. They're restless, irritable, and discontented, unless they can again experience a sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks. Drinks which they see others taking with impunity. Once they succumb to desires, so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, they pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to do it again. This is repeated over and over and over and over and over and over and over. And that's the way it's going on right now in my family. Nobody's going to come to AA. It's being repeated over and over and over. Come from a big family. You know, a lot of them drink. I don't think any of them ever gone to an AA meeting yet. Got 40 cousins. Ain't coming to AA. We're the lucky ones. We got a chance. You know, and I thank God for this program. I thank God for the information that the Big Book gave me. I thank God for helping me see that this is a disease. Not so much for myself. It's okay. I can get myself off the hook. But my God, to get my people off the hook, that's what I needed to do. I needed to get them off the hook. They never made it. They ain't going to make it. They lived out there in that world. They drank out there in that world. And they went to their grave with an illness. And knew absolutely nothing about it. And most people would be that way. We see crowds of people coming in. Throngs of people coming into the program at many times, and all the advertisements and everything we learn about alcoholism, yet most of us never make it to this program. Most of us are going to be just like the rest of my family. With all the blitzes that are out there, you know, people don't see it that way. They just don't see it. We're the lucky ones because we got a chance. I had an old dog at the house, an old mutt dog. I come home one day, I was about 18 years old, and I come into the house, and it was a stoop just like this going from the living room down into the kitchen. This is after we lost the hotel. And I had a six-pack of beer, and I sat down on this linoleum floor, and I was drinking a can of beer. And this old my dog, you know, he comes up to me and he starts sniffing around. So I starts pouring the beer out on the floor. That old my dog starts lapping up the beer. All of a sudden, he disappeared once and he comes walking back in there. Now he's starting to look like a drunk dog. You know, the old ears like this, you know. And he's starting to even look like a drunk dog. Well, I'm pouring his beer out on the floor and he drinks a little bit more and he takes off again. Well, this time he doesn't come back. I didn't care. I mean, he was drinking too much of my beer, probably. Well, the next thing I hear is what the dog had done. He got, and when he left, he was wetting up and down the hall, you know. So my grandfather, he's drunk back in the bedroom, okay? He gets up to go to the bathroom. Now, the dog's passed out on the floor. My grandfather, he slips and falls in the dog urine, and there's the dog laying there. Well, he finds a dog in the darkness, and he grabbed a hold of that dog, and he just started beating the living daylights out of that dog. Now, I'm there laughing. Now, I'm half drunk, and I'm laughing at my grandfather, this drunk dog going down the hall. He finally picks that dog up by the back of the ears and the tail, and he opens the door, and he throws the dog out in the yard, and the dog bounces down through the yard. He comes in, and he turns around and looks at me. Now, he's a little guy in stature, and I looked at him, and I said, "My God, Dad, thank you. Congratulations, up until tonight you had an 0-50 fight record, you know. You finally won one, you know." And he wasn't feeling any pain. He said, "Give me a beer." And he sat down and he drank a beer with me. I don't know whether it was the next night. I don't know whether it was a week later. But I come home again with another six-pack of beer. And I sat down there in the corner of that between the living room and the kitchen. And I called the old dog over. He'd come over there and start sniffing around, pour the beer out on the floor, and he wouldn't touch it. I took that dog's head and I pushed it down into the beer. He never drank again. The dog never drank again. One ass whipping. Now, I laughed at that drunk dog and my grandfather. I laughed. I didn't laugh with them. I was laughing at them. When this was all going on a couple weeks before that. But now, you know, now I'm to learn a lesson. Because alcohol was to do the same things to me that it did to the dog. And my grandfather was going to do the same things to me that he did to the dog. But guess he didn't stop drinking. Guess who wondered, why did I laugh at that? Wonder why that dog quit. I wonder why that dog has more sense than me. There must be something wrong with me. I could never figure that out. God knows. That's a disease of alcoholism. The dog didn't have a mental obsession. You know, the dog was like me and coconut. When I was 10 years old, I used to love coconuts. Coconut Almond Joy, Coconut Mounds. I used to buy whole coconuts and I used to break them open, drink the milk and break them open and eat the coconut. One day I went across the road and I bought a whole box of this Baker's ground up coconut. Took it across the street and I'm sitting there. I used to like to be I wanted to be a carpenter. I watched these guys remodeling this house and I ate that whole box of Baker's ground up coconut. God, did I get sick. Man, I threw up coconut for 3 days. You know, that's been 50 years ago. Do you know how many times in the last 50 years my mind's given me permission to eat coconut again? It's gone. It's done. One time, you know. I can't tell you how many times I get sick with booze. And I go into a store, Sigram's Wine Coors. I'll never forget this, about 20 years ago when they first started making that stuff. I went in there and God knows how many times I get sick drinking Sigram's. My mind goes directly to the Sigram's. You know, Gloria and I, when we first got married, the first time back in 1970, she went to Weight Watchers. So I'll go on a diet with you. See, she brought Freshka home. So I started drinking Freshka and Sigram's. You know, man, I got sick on that damn Freshka. You know, and you know, today, if I go into a store and open it and there's Freshka there, it still makes my stomach roar. But when I see that Sigram's Coors, man, it goes, whoop, it's right on it. You know, it's okay about a little bit of Sigram's. It wouldn't hurt. They didn't make that stuff when you was drinking, Jim. You know, I got a mind, man. It just tricks me all over the place. I got the mind of a chronic alcoholic. You know, that's where the center of my problem lies. I got a mind that at certain times will give me permission even to drink today, even if I don't ask it for it. It just grants it. It gives it to me. Now, it don't have to matter. I don't have to ask it for permission. It's like it says in Fred's story. It's that strange mental blank spots. It's what he says in there. I knew from then it was a crushing blow. I knew then it was a crushing blow. You know. Nothing will ever help me through those strange mental blank spots. That's what happens. That's why I need God's help. That's why I need God's help. Do you know today, without God's help, it's just as, you know, the drinking is an absolute. Now, it says it in the book. I'd have to read it probably to get it out there. That alcohol, drinking, is common sense for me without God's help. Today, with God's help, it's uncommon sense for me to take a drink of alcohol. So when I wake up in the morning before I turn my will and my life over to the care of God, it's common sense for me to take a drink of alcohol. When I turn my will and my life over to the care of God in the morning, it's uncommon sense for me to take a drink with God's help. That's the way it is today. That's the way it was 32 years ago. That's the way it was when I was in my addiction. You know, common sense thus becomes uncommon sense. That's what it says in Bill's story. Common sense thus becomes uncommon sense. With God's help, it's uncommon sense for me to take a drink of alcohol. You know, and that's the way, and you know, and that's through the application of the steps of this program. You know, I came into the program. My drinking took on a whole light of what happened to me. I wound up in institution after institution. I lost two wives. I've lost Gloria. I lost everything that a man could ever hope for. And it wasn't like I just turned into a never was. I mean, I become a good heavy equipment mechanic. I was good, and me and my first wife, we worked hard at things. You know, I alcohol didn't have me by the, you know, like it used to pick me up by the nose and whip me around like a 250-pound rag doll. You know, it didn't have me like that. Little by little, I grew into this stuff. Little by little, it began to affect me. I didn't take a drink of alcohol and compromise every principle and value I ever had in my life. You know, I took a drink of alcohol and I started making a few compromises. I didn't change my whole value system. You know, I didn't change my whole value system overnight. My value system, as a matter of fact, never changed. I justified things in direct conflict with my own value system because I knew something was different about me. I justified things. It's not so much that I took a drink of alcohol, it's that the things I used to justify that stuff, you know. And that's the problem with addiction, that my God, when it goes into this head and comes out the other side, it's justified. And that's scary. That's real scary. And so as my drinking continued to perpetuate, things started leaving little by little. And it talks about this in working with others. It says, while we're drinking, little by little, we withdrew from life, from society, from society, from life itself. I'm a big drinker. Ah, thank you. And little by little. So it wasn't like I took a drink of alcohol and changed my whole vision. I took a drink of alcohol and I started looking at life differently. Instead of looking up here and wanting to be like Mickey Mantle or Willie Mays or the head mechanic of the garage that I worked for, I started looking down here and said, I don't want to be like my old man. It's better than being like my Uncle Frank. It's better than being like some of the other people in my life. You know, that's a vision change. That's a compromise. Somebody else's compromise but my own. Nobody told me I needed to do that. I made the compromise. I switched the vision. Instead of looking in the positive, I started looking in the negative. And you can find the negative. It's out there. Every human being has them. And in order to justify why I sat in the bar till 2-3 o'clock in the morning, my God, you have to be able to do that, and you have to be good at doing it. You know, you not only have to lie, but you have to, no, you don't lie to people, you lie to yourself. When I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous 32 years ago, I basically thought I was still an honest person. I was a pathological liar. You know, not only when it came to everything almost. Because I didn't know the difference. I didn't know what was going on with me. I didn't know changes have taken place. I didn't know what I had to do to get out of this stuff. How could it be my fault? I never planned it to be this way. I never wanted to be this way. I think it's all summed up like the little boy whose mother's catching him in the bathroom messing around with himself. She sets him down, gives him this doomsday story. But what happens to little boys that do these things? And finally she tells him, you keep doing it, you're going to go blind. And he looked up at her and he says, well, Ma's right if I do it just until I have to wear glasses. That's the story of my alcoholism. I was going to stop drinking right before my first wife walked out the door. I knew when she gave me the ultimatum, I knew I'd stop because I loved her. Problem is with people, you know what happens with us? Those of those that don't go to Al-Anon and some that do, they don't give us one compromise, they give us 16. And on the 17th, cutoff time. You know, why'd you forgive me the others? That's what really pees you off. Why'd you forgive me 16 other times? Then you take that to your grave. The problem is we wear them out. We wore the people out. I wore these people out. They gave me the compromises. They gave me the options. And I somehow, some way, I can reconvince them that everything was going to be all right again. I became good because I believed it. I believed it was over. Every time, it wasn't a lie when I said it. I meant it to be over. I wanted it to be over. Who would want to go through this stuff? And yet I still didn't understand what was going on with my life. I just didn't understand, you know. You know, and I think the nature of it is, you know, by the time I came to you people, I had passed that point of wearing glasses. And I think the biggest problem about alcoholism is that I couldn't see that the very same thing that caused me to get divorced helped me to live with the loss of my wife. The very same thing that caused me to lose my job helped me to live with the loss of my job. The very same thing that caused me to put my life in danger helped me to live in that danger. The very same thing that threatened my freedom helped me to live with the loss of that freedom, the threats on that freedom. That's what it was. You know, the very same thing that was killing me was healing me. And I couldn't see that. You know, turning on booze, for me to turn on alcohol would be like turning on my mother. I couldn't do that. Because somewhere along the way, alcohol bore me back into this world. It gave me back my freedom. It gave me a sense of ease and comfort. And whatever negative thing come out of it, I was willing to pay the price. And thank God I had the things that went wrong with me. And those were my curses, though. I was diagnosed with cirrhosis of the liver at 23, 24 years old. I had an esophagus hemorrhage at 24 years old. That's when blood just starts coming out of you by the buckets. Well, the doctor told me if it happens on the operating table, they can't save you. I don't know how it happened. My first wife saved my life. You know, I was bleeding like a stuffed hog. I said, you know, you got to call the ambulance. She said, no. She said, I'll take you. I thought, oh my God, she's going to take me out in the field and drop me off. But by this time, she probably could have done that. You know, I thought, oh God, she's going to try to kill me. She's just going to go real slow. But thank God she had a moment of, you know, she went back to saving my life once again. Off she rode to the hospital, and she got me there in time. I should have called the hospital. The doctor said, that woman calls the hospital, you die. She saved your life. You know, but me, man, I thought, oh God, school's out. You know, when you're threatened to push the butcher knife in, and the next day she jumps on it, and you're in trouble. You've done wore out. Somebody's welcome. You know, that's what I did to people. I passed that point of no return. I turned people that were very innocent, sweet, loving people, and they didn't understand. I think there's a point in time where people would rather get it on physically than go through any more emotional pain or emotional lies that we put them through. And that's the nature of what alcoholism is. You know. And to cause that in people, gentle, loving people, to have them looking in the eye like they're a crushed little puppy dog and have that look of empathy about them is the worst look in the world. I've seen that look too many times. I've caused that look too many times. You know, I'm grateful for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and what it's given me, that I don't have to do those things anymore. I just don't have to do those things anymore. I reached that point where I'd passed that point of wearing glasses. I wound up in the psychiatric ward of St. Francis Hospital for the umpteenth time. The psychiatrist there told me, son, you've been here 11 other times. He said, and I told you 11 other times, if you drink again, you're going to die. He said, I got some news for you. You ain't going to die in your addiction. People like you probably won't die. If you continue to drink, you'll probably live to be a bum on Skid Row till you're 80 years old. And I thought, my God, that's it. I'm not going to die, I'm going to live. And that little rabbi saved my life that day. Because he told me, and a year before that, they had lodged me in the Allegheny County Prison because I wouldn't sign commitment papers for a year and a day because of my drinking. And I went back in there under the full determination that he was going to commit me. I thought he would. I mean, my God, he was going to put me in Danville. Why wouldn't he do it now? And he said, you're not going to Danville. You're not going to Woodville. You're not going to Mayview. You're not going to Chitchat. You're not going to Eagleville. You're not going back to St. John's. There's only one place left for somebody like you. And I said, where's that? He said, Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought, my God, what are those people ever going to do for somebody like me? They've really given up on me for sure now. That's the way I felt. I felt like they were throwing me to the wolves. I thought, why don't you give me some psychiatric help? He said, you stay in this hospital no more than 5 days. No medication. When you get back out, you go back over to that flop house that you was living in. You go to meetings, and I'll give you a name of a guy to be your sponsor. You go to meetings, you stay sober. He said, son, if the program of Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't work, you have absolutely nothing to lose. If AA doesn't work, you don't lose nothing. What do you lose if it doesn't work? And I was upset. I was upset because they weren't giving me any medication. I was upset because they were sentencing me to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I didn't think that was enough. They put me back on the ward. That little lady come back here. I was up back here yelling and hollering, and she come back here, and she said, what do you want, Mr. Swagger? I said, lady, I need some medication. She said, you're not going to get any medication. What's going to happen if you don't get any medication? I said, lady, if you don't give me any medication, I'll tear this whole damn room apart. She said, Mr. Swagger, in case you do flip by, please shut the door so you don't bother the other resident in my hospital. And she walked away. That was it. She walked out, left me sitting there. I'm thinking, my God, it's up. It's up. I knew it was up. I knew when I woke up. 2 days before that. I knew when I woke up in that flop house on Skid Row. I knew that I was responsible for being there. And the other thing I knew how hard I worked to get there. I knew how hard I had to work to get there. I didn't know it then, but I know today it was the hardest thing I ever done in my life. Because if it wouldn't have been hard, I'd still be out there doing it. Staying sober is the second hardest thing I've ever done in my life. Staying drunk's the hardest thing I've ever done in my life because I couldn't do it. I can pick up a drink of alcohol. I could start drinking, but stay that way. It seemed like every time I took a drink, I'd bob back up somewhere. There he goes. He bobbed back up. Put him away in a nut house somewhere. Put him in jail. Put him in a detox. Put him someplace. I couldn't stay drunk. My dad never quit. My grandfather never quit. Most of my people never quit. They just don't quit. They never bought back up. They didn't go to a hospital. What was wrong with me? I was a fortunate one. Because I had enough things go wrong with me that forced me into a position where I had to do something about it. And yet I thought those were the greatest curses of my life. I didn't understand what was wrong with that. I went back to that flop house. I started going to meetings. I got a sponsor, Nick. Nick T. Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I met that guy, and the first thing I said to him, I said, I'm going to quit drinking. He said, son, I'm going to tell you something. People like you and me can't stop drinking. What we need to do, let's just stay sober today. You want to go out and get drunk? We'll go out and get drunk tomorrow together. But let's just try staying sober today. I thought, man, what's wrong with this character? I said, well, hell, I said, I got to stop going in them bars. Now, you don't have to stop going to the bar, son. Let's just stay sober today, go to an AA meeting tonight. You want to go out and get drunk in the bar tomorrow night with me? We'll go out and get drunk in the bar tomorrow night. We'll go together. I said, oh, my God, what's wrong with this guy? I said, I got to give up all my old friends. He said, no, you don't have to do that either. He said, let's just stay sober today, go to a meeting tonight, meet a new friend in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. AA takes nothing away from you. It's a given program. It gives you a meeting to go to, a day of sobriety, a meeting to go to, and a new friend in the program. But the other way of life will always be out there, and it still is. It still is. Somebody asked me today if my old friend's still drinking. Yeah, two of them are. I had a lot of, most of the people I knew in AA when I got sober are gone. Hell, I got two friends out there still plugging away at it. I got a friend here tonight that plugged away for 20-some years. He's sober today. Thank God for that. You know, we think we're going to go out there and have a little drink and everything's going to be all right. Tomorrow we'll get it together. We don't call the shots. Booze calls the shots. You know. And I love that man. He told me to go to meetings. How many meetings you go to? He said, how many nights a week you get drunk? I didn't have to. How many meetings you going to? He was going to 10 meetings a week then. And I didn't know it, but he had gotten injured and had a back injury, so he didn't have anything else to do. He wasn't working, so he just went to 10 meetings a week. So I went to 14. Saved my life. Never told me the truth about that one. You know. Started going to meetings. Gloria and I, we got back together again. You know, after I met Gloria after I got out of a treatment center. First thing I told Gloria, I said, you know, after we had dated, not the first thing. I told her I was an alcoholic the first time I left her. I said, if I ever drink, leave me. Then after we started talking about getting married, I said, you know, that first wife of mine, she put me up there in that nut house. Now, if we get married, I want you to promise me one thing. You don't ever put me in that nut house. Oh, my God. She said, there has to be something wrong with that woman. How could anybody put you in a place like that? I said, that's right. She must have been an awful person. 2 months after we got married, she put me in the nut house. And then she has the audacity now. Here she goes. She has the audacity to come in there and visit me. I said, what do you want? Look what you put me in. Why'd you put me in here? She said, Jimmy, I come home from work. You're behind the orange couch. You had an empty bottle of Mogan David wine in your hand. You had it around the neck and you were squeezing it and crying over it and saying, booze is boss, booze is boss, booze is boss, booze is boss. She said, I called the neighbors, I called everybody. Nobody could stop you. You're trying to kill the bottle of wine saying, booze is boss. She said, I don't understand. I had to call the paramedics, haul you off. I don't understand what was wrong. And then I remembered. I sat down at the table, and the kitchen table in there, and I had a full bottle, a gallon of Mogan David wine, and the lid was on that thing, and I grabbed it around, and I said, I'm boss. I'm boss. Booze ain't boss no more. And then I took the lid off. And when I took the lid off, I wound up in the nut house kicking and screaming again. You know. And it says that in Bill's story. Exactly what happened to me. And I think the earlier chapters, Bill's story, the chapter There Is a Solution and more about alcoholism are the chapters that I probably study the most today. They're the chapters that the longer I stay sober, the more I understand the disease of addiction, the more I understand this book and why it's been written the way it's been written. And the more I understand Bill's story. And I thank God for what it talks about in here. On the bottom of page 7, it says, they did not need to tell me. This is after his wife said he was going to turn him over to the undertaker, the asylum. And he says, they did not need to tell me. I knew and almost welcomed the idea. It was a devastating blow to my pride. I, who had thought so well of myself and my abilities, my capacity to surmount obstacles were cornered at last. Now I was to plunge into the dark, joining the endless procession of sots who had gone on before. I thought of my poor wife. There had been much happiness after all. What I would not give to make amends, but that was over now. The words can tell the loneliness and despair. I found that bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I had met my match. I'd been overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master. Booze was boss. Booze was boss. Couldn't stop it. Worst day of my life wasn't the day I got sober on Skid Row. It was 4 years before I had, 3 years before I ended up there. I stood beside that toolbox that high. I had them, they were jammed with tools, but in the middle drawer, there was a solution in there. It was the things that I took during the day to get me the booze at night. And I ate them like they were candy. But I knew that those things that were in that drawer, I knew that that night that they were part of the problem. But what I also knew that night, that they were the solution to my problem, and that I was going to ultimately destroy myself and lose everything I love and everything I hope for just by living. All I had to do was live, and it was going to be gone, and there was nothing I could do about it. Because I thought I tried AA and it didn't work. I tried treatment, it didn't work. I thought I tried everything and it didn't work. I thought I'd given everything my best shot and it wasn't working for me. And that was true. The moment of truth. The moment of truth had hit. So I went to meetings. Gloria and I got back together again. She come home from work. How long have I been talking? I don't know what time I started. Okay. She came home from work one day. We had gotten back together again, and she came home from work very gently, very lovingly. She says, Jimmy, I realize you're really doing a good job going to all these AA meetings, but when are you going to get a job and start putting some support into this family? I thought, my God, she's lost her mind. How can I go to 14 AA meetings a week and go to work? So, but I had to. I went to my sponsor. He said, you know that flop house you was living in before you and her got back together again? I said, he said, you can live over there and stay sober and don't pay nothing and go to meetings and you don't have to work over there. You just go over there and collect your check and go to meetings. You want to stay up there between the silk sheets? You better go get a job. I made the decision. I want to be up there in the silk sheets. So I went out to get a big shot truck mechanic job. They weren't hiring me. One of my old bosses sent me up to talk to his preacher up to church, and he gave me a job mowing grass in a cemetery for $2 an hour. Now my pride was in the way now, because I told everybody I was going out and getting a heavy equipment mechanic job again. I didn't have no tools, so nobody was hiring me. So people in AA asked me, where are you going to work? And I said, well, I'm going to work with these Christians up there at the church up there, but I'll do them a favor because I'll be able to work on all their equipment, take care of business. I'll just be an asset to them, you know. I had total humility the day I got sober. Now I'm arrogant. 3 months later, I'm filled with arrogance. I went home to Gloria. She said, what are you going to do? I said, I got a job mowing grass up at the cemetery at Buell's Church. Not making very much money, $2 an hour, but by God, I'll be able to do them people a favor. I'll be able to go up there and work and do what I need to do and go to meetings as much as I can. I went up there at 8 o'clock Monday morning. In 10 o'clock, I got fired. This old man who had retired, who volunteered his service toward the truck, his church, I was slipping a clutch on this red tractor, and that old man come out there, and Harry come out there and almost knocked me off that red tractor right in front of all these other people. He humiliated me. So I let him have it with my vocabulary, and oh, Lord, it was terrible, you know. One word after another, prefaced them all with mother and all that stuff. And he fired me. And I went running off, giving them all my gyrations, went to jump in that old car. I must have revved that thing up to 25,000 RPMs to back out of there and run off. And I said, you know, I said to myself when that engine roaring as loud as it could, I said, you know, what are you going to go tell that woman? You made $4 today. What are you going to go tell those people in Alcoholics Anonymous? You can't keep a $2 an hour job anymore than two hours. I'm going to go back and tell that old man I'm sorry. I knew it was coming, and I was ready for it, because that man hurt me when I went back and I apologized to him, because that man did something that never happened before in my life. See, I was ready for him again. I was ready to let him have it again, because he wasn't going to forgive me, and that old man forgave me unconditionally. And it still hurts me today that he did that to me. Because when I went up there with all this violence and all that came out was, that was all that was left in me. He absolutely forgave me. And if I was him, I'd have spit on me if I was him. But that old man forgave me. He said, please don't ever swear at me again. And I worked my butt off for the next 9 months just to keep that $2 an hour job. Greatest job I ever had in my life. Greatest job I ever had in my life. The greatest year I ever had in my life, when Gloria and I got back together. We had that job, and we did everything. We come to Alabama. We did everything. It was like waking up every day to Christmas. As crazy as I was, it was just unbelievable. I was out there mowing grass in the cemetery. there was an old historical part of the cemetery down across the road, and I had to mow that down there too. And he had to take care of it pretty good. And I was down there in an old red tractor one night, and I always had this terror of ghosts coming after me. And man, down there, you know, up in the modern part of the cemetery, those people didn't bother you that much. By God, them old ones down there, down over the hill, especially late at night when the dusk is start coming over. Man, I'm driving, trying to mow the grass, and all of a sudden, man, I seen something behind me, and I put that thing in high gear, headed out of that cemetery, my rear end bouncing off the tractor that high, got into the shed, I slid it in the slits, in the, like Lou Brock sliding into second base, jumped out of that tractor, went off to an AA meeting, scared to death, come into church. I got up real early that morning to come up to fix whatever I fixed, because I run some headstones over getting out of there. Come into the church, they were having a meeting. I got there early, and they were there before me. I said, "What's going on, Jim? Something terrible. What happened?" "Somebody vandalized a cemetery last night." I said, "No." I said, "Nobody vandalized a cemetery. That was me that did that." Now, I should have, you know, don't tell the whole truth. You know, if I'd have just left it go at that, that it gave me my tractor back. But I told them about the ghost. And man, they couldn't have a guy running around, you know, wrecking headstones and that with a ghost. So they took my riding lawnmower off me. Now, if you think those people feel bad about being rode on, you ought to see them when they're walked on. Man, they get really peed. I'm down there with that lawnmower running through that cemetery trying to cut that grass. Never at night either. After about a month, they still haven't given me my lawnmower back. Me and Gloria ain't getting along too well. The honeymoon's over. She already starting to put pressure on me to ask for a raise. AA ain't going too well either. Sobriety ain't that great. Now I'm standing down there in that cemetery and I'm bitching because my sobriety ain't doing very well. Me and my wife ain't getting along too good. And ain't giving my tractor back. And I look down at this old shell headstone of a little boy who had died back in 1816. And across the thing it said Timothy. And now I'm standing on this little boy's grave who was 7 years old when he died, and I'm bitching on his grave, you see. And the only thing I knew to do at that time was to fall on my knees and apologize to this little boy who had been dead almost 200 years. I apologized to that little boy. I said, "I'm sorry, little boy, because you see, I'm still trying to throw my life away. Please forgive me for bitching on your grave." And the greatest spiritual experience I've ever had in my life was when I got up and walked away from that little grave, I had a sense of gratitude for just being alive. That's been 100% effective from that day to this day. It's the greatest spiritual experience I've ever had in my life. I've worked the fourth step. I had awakenings. I've had things happen to me that are gentle and kind in this problem. I've given a lot of freebies. People sacrificed a lot for me. People gave me back my life. People put it on the line for me. The only one that's left in AA, Mary Lou, I was talking to Larry about her. The only one that's left up there, and I love that little woman. Every day I'd call her from the church, and we went to meetings together, and Nick told me, my sponsor told me to talk to her, because she's been in some of them same nut houses that you've been in, took them pills, and I don't know about that stuff. Go talk to her about it. So I did. One day I called her from the church, and I said, "This is it. It's over. I got to see you. Come on over, Jim." Drove her to her house 90 miles an hour. I've been only in her house one other time. I screeched my car in front of her house. I didn't even knock on a door. I run down the hallway. She's standing doing the dishes at the end of the at the sink at the end of the hall. And I looked at her. I come down. I was 280 pounds. I must have looked like a rhinoceros coming down that hall. She never flinched. I made a left, went into the kitchen, sat down at the table. She said, "My God, Jim, what's the matter with you?" I said, "Mary Lou, I feel like I'm going to blow up." And she just she stared at me. And I said, "For God's sake, didn't I tell you I feel like I'm going to blow?" And she kept doing her dishes and staring at me. And I said, "What in the hell's wrong with you?" She said, "Jim, I'm just waiting to see what happens when you blow." She saved my life. Nobody ever waits out a 280-pound rhinoceros. You either put Thorazine in it, you put shock treatments on it, or you put it in a straitjacket. That 130-pound woman waited me out. She saved my life. That little woman saved my life. because she waited me out. And that's what you people did. You people waited me out. You gave me courage. You showed me where I had love. You showed me where I had patience. Long before I was capable of doing this, you people gave me the sixth and seventh step, long before I was capable of even looking at it. That's what you taught me by going to meetings, giving me little pats on the back. You know, it says that in Dr. Bob's last message. None of us would be here today if somebody wouldn't have done numerous kind little things on our behalf. And I can't quote it. I got it written in my book. Thank God for those people, because they saved my life. They did more. And they helped me back into the mainstream of life. They helped me adhere to this program. And I thank God for those people today. You know, little by little, I've gotten back involved with the social life of the world. Little by little, I've watched my children raised, my kids are raised, my daughter went off and got married, now she's going through a divorce, and there's addiction involved with that, not on her side. You know, and it's a tragedy, because I know the difference today. I love this boy, yet I know she can't go through it. And yet, you know, he's in the midst of it. He ain't ready to stop. And that's tough when you love somebody who's giving you two beautiful little grandbabies. And you know that this stuff's involved in that. There's nothing you can do about it. Sometimes knowing the difference hurts like hell. Sometimes ignorance is bliss, you know. But you know what? That's why I need God's help. Because I've got a release from that. You see, I never put children through, my kids through. But those kids are going to go through, but they're going through. And yet I know intellectually, I know that I'd have run through kids the same way I run through everything else in life, like they were duck pins in a bowling alley. Didn't matter. And yet there's that judgment. I'd have never done that to those little babies. That's a bunch of crock. Everything that was in my road went down. And I'm all of a sudden now, not if they were little. Nah, that's not true. That's far from the truth. You know, so, you know, sometimes the truth, you know, sometimes it's just like Nicholson says, we can't handle the truth, you know, and that's it. That's why we need God's help sometimes. And I thank God for the information I've been given. I thank God for a sponsor. Another thing my sponsor told me early on, and I had a bad resentment against this guy, and he'd come up to me, he says, I won't tell you the way these people tell me. You know, one of the things that my people did, they gave me my spirituality in the same gutters that I was in. That's what they gave to me. I can't express it to you up here. Some people say it's dogmatic, but that's the way it was given to me. You know, but I can't, and you know, I won't do that. But the thing about it is, you know, they delivered these things in a manner of speaking. They told me, he said, you know, that, you know, I want you to get to know that person that you resent. I said, what are you talking about? He said, because you're going to die over that person. You don't even know him, do you? No, I don't know him. But you hate him, don't you? Yeah, I hate him. Well, you're going to die over somebody you hate. If you're going to die over somebody, at least die over somebody you know, for God's sake. Don't die over somebody you don't know. You know, die over somebody you love. Get to know him. Get to know what's going to kill you. Because your resentment toward that guy is going to get you drunk. Same thing would happen in the area of those, about my son-in-law. I can't let my resentments for him get my ass drunk. You know, I can't do it. I had to turn that over to somebody that's better qualified to handle it. You know, I had to. You know, my mother, when I was sober, I'll be done in a minute. I was sober 3-4 years, and my mother came down to the trucking firm where I was working. She was crying, coming across the parking lot. And I thought something happened to one of the kids, I didn't have kids at that time. And I said, what's wrong? And my stepdad had taken off and left her for another woman. And she's crying, no wonder you drank, no wonder you did the things you do. Oh, God, Jimmy, I'm so sorry for getting involved with that man. I said, whoa, Mom, whoa, Mom, I want you to stop right now. Please stop. I said, Mother, I love you. If you want me to kill him, I'll hunt him down and I'll kill him right now. But if you don't want me to kill him, you better go get a lawyer and you better divorce him. That's my solution. She turned, walked away, never mentioned him again for as long as she lived or he lived. Never mentioned it. Would I have killed him? I don't know. I know one thing. If I'd have sat there and started resenting that man again, I'd have died. I'd have died resenting them, and I'd have still would have never killed them. You know, I'd have turned on that get-even machine, but I'd have never done nothing about it. Hell, that get-even machine, you can grind them up and spit them out and bury them. You don't have to do nothing about it. Just sit there and soak in it. That's what this program gave to me, an opportunity to take action, an opportunity to get it right, an opportunity to do the things in my life that I need with God's help. I thank God for this program and you people in it. But every day in my life, more than anything else in this world, I thank each and every one of you people in this program for giving me that God. Thank you very much.